We keep hearing about the demise of the book industry, but it's not for lack of reading. Just look at all those people with their faces in their phones, and it's clear we read now more than ever. And today's guest put some quality stuff out there in a new anthology. The Unprofessionals features new American writing from the Paris Review, the influential magazine. Lauren Stein is the editor of the Paris Review, has been since 2010, and its third editor at that. His works of criticism and translations have appeared in the New York Review of Books, the London Review of Books, and more. And he's an editor-at-large at the publisher Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Lauren Stein, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much for having me.
For the people who might never have heard of Paris Review and never seen a copy, can you give us a bit of history?
Sure. The Paris Review is a literary magazine that comes out four times a year, and it was founded in 1953 by a handful of young American expatriates in Paris. And the magazine moved to New York in the late 50s into the home of its editor, George Plimpton, who edited the magazine for 50 years. I'm only the third editor that the magazine has ever had. 5 years ago, when I came, my colleagues and I brought a new team with me, and we relaunched the magazine to actually take it back to its original mission to promote especially young writers of fiction and poetry and literary essays, or I should say emerging writers, as well as publishing famous writers who are already very well known, and not to worry about anything except writing for writing's sake. And to our surprise, in the last 5 years since we did that, the magazine's circulation has almost doubled and is actually much higher now than it's ever been in the history of the magazine. So, like you, I worry about the book business, but we've seen a huge increase in our print readership. That's really surprising to us, but very gratifying.
The print readership, too. I assumed it was all online readership, but it's print, too.
Oh, no. It's overwhelmingly a print readership. That's right.
Wow. You did add a number of online sorts of wrinkles when you became editor 5 years ago, didn't you?
We did. We sell all of our... I mean, it's kind of... It's like that line from The Leopard, if you want to stay the same, everything has to change. We sell all of our subscriptions now over our website, and in fact, we maintain a very popular blog. We get a million page views a month at theparisreview.org, but that's really so that we can keep doing the quarterly, so that we can keep providing a space for writing that is not online, but really is written for the page and for readers who want to be on the page.
Lauren Stein, it sounds like through its history, Paris Review has taken chances on writers passed on by other organizations.
That's true. That's a big part of our job.
Mm-hmm.
We were the first to publish Jack Kerouac, one of the first to publish Philip Roth. David Foster Wallace published one of his first long stories in the Review. Adrienne Rich, her first poems. Jay McInerney, Jeffrey Eugenides, these are all writers who started out in the Paris Review.
Is the Paris Review's recent success counter to what's happening to other literary magazines? I just wonder what the trend is in the industry.
Well, that's part of why we relaunched it, but why I was a book editor, and what I saw around me, what we all saw around us, my colleagues and I, was that the little magazines that we'd grown up on that had mattered so much to us had tended to fold. They'd gone out of business or they seemed to have kind of given up a little bit. And no one was doing the kind of work that really held our attention as involved readers of American literature. So we wanted to create a space that had been shrinking, and I think it's a sad fact. I think part of the reason that so many readers have come to the Paris Review is because there aren't enough magazines doing that right now.
So without the likes of the Paris Review to publish new work and writers, where do they go?
Well, they don't luckily we're around, but if we weren't around, I'm not sure what writers would do. I like to think another magazine would spring up to take our place, but I don't know that.
You're not about to try to find out either, I'm sure.
I'd rather not.
No. So why is this book called The Unprofessionals?
Well, this is a book. These last 5 years have been, to my surprise, I mean, I've been in the book business for more than 20 years, but these last 5 years have been really, really shockingly fertile. A lot of new writers have come along who we'd never heard of 5 years ago, who've already really changed the way American literature is sounding. And it was because of that that we decided to make an anthology. This is something that the Paris Review has not done in more than half a century, but an anthology of new writing, and specifically new writing by younger writers, so writers in their 20s, 30s, a few who are in their early 40s, but this is almost all writing done by people in their 30s. And it's people who grew up before the internet was everywhere, but who've come of age as writers in the internet age. And I don't think there's really been a snapshot of the leaders of this new generation yet, and until this one. And we called it The Unprofessionals not because these people don't know what they're doing. They all know what they're doing. But because I think they're all taking a stand against the personal / professional writing that fills up our days on social media, where we're all called on to be marketers, essentially.
Mm-hmm. So it's not quite that level of stuff, but it's good stuff for sure. It is called The Unprofessionals, New American Writing from the Paris Review, edited by Lauren Stein, who's also our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Lauren. If you'd like to join us by phone or email, you're welcome to do so as well. We'll return to the Jefferson Exchange with Lauren Stein and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about writing, specifically new American writing, as featured in a new anthology put out by the Paris Review. The book is called The Unprofessionals, edited by Lauren Stein, who's also the editor of the Paris Review, the literary magazine. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about writing and publishing generally and about some of the specific works in The Unprofessionals. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Lauren, you mentioned it had been quite a long time, more than 50 years since the Paris Review put out an anthology. Talk about the decision process that led up to the creation of the Unprofessionals.
Well, we've actually put out anthologies of interviews and sort of retrospective anthologies where we cover 50 years of material, but it's been a long time since we wanted to do a book that's focused on what's happening right now. And it's because this moment really strikes us as an unusual one. That's not something I would have said 5 years ago. But if you told me 5 years ago about some of these writers, I mean, Ben Lerner, the novelist who in his mid-30s is surely the most written about novelist of his age group, he hadn't written a page of fiction 5 years ago. Neither had Atticus Lish. Angela Flournoy hadn't written a novel. John Jeremiah Sullivan hadn't put out a book of essays. I mean, how often is a book of essays a bestseller? Well, John's it was. So things have changed a lot in these 5 years, and these are all writers who have really changed the sound of what American writing is.
You make quite a case for short fiction over novels, and you use the word I had to read several times to make sure I got it right, interiority. So what are the advantages, and specifically that interiority that you mention in short fiction?
Well, don't get me wrong. I love novels. Mm-hmm. But, you know, someone who put it better than me is one of our contributors, a woman named Otessa Moshfegh, who's written a couple of novels, but has also written a bunch of short stories. And I would say that there's no one... no young writer who writes better short stories than Otessa. She said this is something that really struck me. She said, a good short story can break my heart in a way a novel just can't. Novels require so much human tinkering. The author's fingerprints are all over the place. When I read a short story, a good one, the author disappears from me. I think that's the thing about a short story, is that novels have lots of machinery in them. The plot needs to move in a certain way in a certain kind of novel. Someone has to propose marriage in another kind of novel. Someone has to get his comeuppance or whatever it is. In a short story, you can construct a short story that is equally believable at every moment, and where it's like watching a great movie where you know that any little thing you notice is there for a reason. You know, it's the same way that if you're watching a Truffaut movie or, I don't know, Apocalypse Now, you know that any little thing, no matter how accidental seeming, is the product of long, long thought.
Oh, like why did the shot linger on that thing? You know it's going to come up later in the movie.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's the same thing with short stories.
And Otessa Moshfegh is up first in the book, actually, with a short story called Dark and Winding Road. And wow, some minds you really don't want to visit, but boy, it's fascinating to get in there, isn't it?
I love that story, obviously. I think it's really, I mean, that's a story about sexual shame. And a lot of, I mean, among other things, but I find that I'm interested in stories and poems that talk about intimate things and maybe even especially shameful things, or things that are difficult, that would be impossible to talk about if you were a decent person, if you were talking about yourself, if you were writing nonfiction. There are things that are just that I don't think any of us can really talk about reliably.
No, this is not the kind of stuff you'd bring up in any kind of conversation with your most intimate friend.
And if you did, you'd be completely untrustworthy, right? And so people wouldn't listen. That's right.
Yeah, I did want to give away too much because, you know, people should read the story, but one of the best lines is right at the end. So that's exactly why I'm not giving it away. We have a call here from...
I love that line, too.
It's wonderful. Mark in Reading, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lauren Stein, the editor of The Unprofessionals.
Good morning. I'm wondering, where do you find your new writers? Do they throw their work over the transom, or do they have agents, or how do they go about getting to you?
Excellent question. Thanks, Mark.
Great question. The answer is both of the above. People send us, we get thousands of submissions a year. And they come to our general inbox, and some come through the mail, and some come from agents. And sometimes they come from book editors, people who are especially smaller publishers who have something that isn't going to come out for a couple of years, but they want to show the world. The Paris Review has... I mean, it has a larger circulation than any other literary magazine in America, but I think its core readership, the readership it's always had, is editors and agents, so that a lot of times it's a good place to start out. It's a good place to get attention.
Have most of the writers been published in some form or another? As I peruse the list of the writers in the back, it seems like they've all gotten a few things out there.
Well, by now. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of, these are people who we've published over the last 5 years, and some of them have done a fair amount of publishing since then. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people we publish have published things out in other places, but a fair number haven't, or have done very little of it. Yeah, we love publishing favorites of ours, like Lydia Davis or Roberto Bolaño or James Salter gave us a piece of fiction and a piece of nonfiction right before he died. But there's a special excitement in publishing someone who we've never heard of before.
So it's not quite like the Grammys where they'll award the best new artist to somebody who's already had six albums or something like that. I mean, these people really haven't seen the light of day before that.
We try not to give our Grammys to the sixth time out.
Sounds good. What were the criteria then, Lauren, for inclusion in this collection?
Well, it's stuff that we love. I mean, I guess there's something the fiction that speaks to me. I mean, if we'd limit it to the fiction, the stories that speak to me most tend to have three qualities. A narrator whose existence I really believe in, who really wants to tell a story that is true, to convince the reader that the story is true, and it's something really burning. And then the third thing is that often there's a certain kind of wisdom to the story, that the narrator is trying to settle a troubling matter of conscience. And that makes it sound preachy. I don't really mean it that way, but there's a kind of troubledness that a lot of stories have that in common. And I guess in a certain way that the same is true for the essays and poems that we publish. But it starts with the voice, I would say.
The troubledness certainly comes through. I went and snapped right to the idea of Kristen Dombeck's letter from Williamsburg. This is a person wrestling with leaving God and religion behind and waking up one morning and thinking, well, I'm going to pray now. Oh, wait a minute, I don't pray anymore. I mean, this is a really challenging concept.
Yeah. Isn't that a beautiful essay?
It truly is.
And the odd thing about that essay is that it ends up in talking in a way I've never seen anyone talk about threesomes and sexual experimentation in a tone of voice that has everything to do with the writer's deep, deep experience of Christianity and her own struggles with her faith. I would never have imagined that those two subjects would go together, or that if they went together, it would seem respectful or serious. But to my mind, it does.
Which is an amazing feat. And as I believe me, as I wrote the question after reading the first couple of pages, then got to the end of it and went, "Well, this really took a turn." But she pulls it off.
She did. I'm glad you feel that way too.
Lauren Stein is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the editor of the Paris Review, the Literary Quarterly, and he's also the editor of a compilation of new American writing from the Paris Review called The Unprofessionals, now out in paperback in its brand new form. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the conversation by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Just two stories in, Lauren, I realize one of the major challenges of short writing, which is efficient description. They really have to get a lot communicated in a short amount of time. And then no sooner had I thought that, and then I realized we were talking about John Jeremiah Sullivan here, who's one of the Paris Review's editors. Tell us a bit about him.
Oh, John Sullivan is, well, he's just a terrific essayist. He has boundless curiosity about the world. Right now he's finishing a book on 18th century American history about an Enlightenment philosopher who snuck into what is now Kentucky, and tried to organize the Cherokee to drive the English to the sea. And he created a utopia where slaves could be free and where Indians and slaves and whites would live together. That's one kind of thing he thinks a lot about. He is also very well known as a historian of the blues. But what he wrote about for us, and it's probably the piece that's gotten us the most, well, certainly awards. It's a piece about being a young man at Sewanee, a very old college in the South, and falling under the spell of a retired professor named Andrew Lytle, and becoming a kind of apprentice to this old writer, who was a very conservative member, the last living member of the Fugitive group of kind of right-wing modernist Southern writers of the early 20th century. And this man, loving this man and finding him very difficult and trying to come to grips with what it meant to be from the South and what it means to be a man too.
It's pretty amazing in that it does, and because he's so good at description, you get a real physical sense of the almost smoky and sticky nature of Mr. Lytle's house, and the broken down physical presence, but the beautiful mind within that, getting grosser by the minute body.
That beautiful, difficult mind. Yeah, absolutely.
We've talked about the short prose. Give us a sketch of the poetry that you chose for The Unprofessionals.
Well, I should say that I choose the prose for the magazine, but that we have a poetry editor named Robin Cresswell, and he's sort of like John Sullivan. He leads a very interesting intellectual life. By day, he's a professor of Arabic literature and specializes in Arabic modernism, and in fact, recently wrote a fascinating article for The New Yorker about the poetry that's being written by ISIS fighters, which we don't pay much attention to, but it's a very interesting window into the interior world. It's the way that ISIS speaks to ISIS rather than the way they speak to outsiders. So Robin is interested in poetry, and I feel the same way as a part of everyday life. And we have a kind of odd relationship to the poetry in the magazine, or a sense of mission that's different from other magazines, because we both pay attention to poetry journals that are really edited by poets for poets. They're really professional magazines, and we want to publish poems for people who are interested and educated readers but are not self-identified poetry readers. And if we publish a poem that gets ripped out of the magazine and stuck up on the fridge door, we don't consider that a failure at all. We kind of like that.
I can imagine. And so do the fridge doors. Let's take a call here from, we have Jeannie in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lauren Stein, the editor of the Paris Review.
Hi. Remember, Jeffrey, when you had Anne Rule on, may she rest in peace? I was fortunate enough to learn from her how to write a good short story, only because she said about my long stories, learn to encapsulate. Uh-huh. And I never forgot that. And I go, holy mackerel, I wrote a great short story the past year. And also about the Spanish language. If we say red fast, I could be thinking Corvette. But in Spanish, I notice the object comes first. Car. Okay, now I'm on the same page. Red and fast.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for that, Jeannie. Appreciate it. Some thoughts about writing technique there. I wonder as I read through this stuff myself, and if you flip through the unprofessionals, you can see within a few paragraphs where things are going. And I wonder what kinds of judgments you guys made as editors when picking these things in the first place. I have this image of what goes on in my business where, particularly in television, news directors will look at the first few seconds of a tape and go, nah, or oh, I'm going to keep watching.
Yep, that's exactly the way it works here. You generally know within a sentence whether it's something that you want to keep reading. There's such a difference in sound between the stuff that speaks to and the stuff that doesn't. I mean, for better or worse, that might mean that maybe with more patience we'd be slightly more reliable readers. But in real life, it's just very rare that, maybe not the first sentence, but that if the first paragraph isn't speaking to you, it's pretty unlikely that the third one will. When the works are this short, you know, and most of my grown-up life, I was a book editor, and a difference between being a book editor and editing the Paris Review is that, with some exceptions, especially in the essays, if we fall in love with it, we're probably not going to monkey with it very much because it's so short to begin with.
Mm-hmm. You know, I still am amazed at what can be conveyed in a very short span, and I come to Angela Flournoy in the story Leela, asking in six words, "Where do the homeless make toast?" She just whacks us upside the head with the reality of that situation.
Yeah, this is a woman who is packing her stuff up because she's getting kicked out of her house. She's losing her home, and she's trying to think what to take with her, and the question of whether to take the toaster. I love the wit of that piece. It's adapted with a lot of changes, actually, from Angela's first novel, which was nominated for the National Book Award this year, actually. She's a tremendous young writer, and that story is very... I love the way she puts you in sympathy with this woman who's fallen on hard times, and after you sympathize with her, you learn something about her that might have made it harder to sympathize with her. You find that she's done herself in because she's addicted to gambling and is about to fall off the wagon again. But by that time, you already really respect her.
You do. It's in a really, really good piece. Sarah Manguso writes a piece called Short Days, which, I don't know, it struck me kind of like reading Jack Handy's material.
I loved it. Someone compared it the other night to a harrowing stand-up routine.
It's kind of like that. Riffs like this one. I never joined Facebook because I want to keep my old longings exactly as they were. Don't Facebook people wonder where their desires have gone? I mean,
isn't that great?
really is. And then what was the other thing about ghosts? She says, I've never seen a ghost and I don't believe in them. I might see one tonight, but even then I wouldn't believe in ghosts. I'd believe in that ghost.
Isn't that great? That speaks volumes to me. That there's so much about life that's like that. And Sarah Manguso is such an original and brilliant writer. She's written memoir, she's written poems. These are aphorisms and they're really about writing, but also about sex and about marriage, and I found myself loving each one.
There's some good stuff in there. Much more to talk about of the contents of The Unprofessionals, New American Writing from the Paris Review, edited by Lauren Stein, who is the editor of the magazine. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back with Lauren Stein in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Lauren Stein, the editor of the Paris Review, the literary quarterly, now going on, getting close to 60, actually more than 60 years, I guess 62 years since its formation, revamped and relaunched by Lauren Stein in 2010. He's now put out with the rest of the staff at the Paris Review an anthology, New American Writing from the Paris Review, called The Unprofessionals. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, or jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about Sarah Manguso and her piece called Short Days, with just the haunted stand-up routine, or whatever you want to call it. In my imagination, Lauren, earlier editors would have rejected this piece as silly. Am I imagining too much stuffiness on the part of older editors?
I think the Paris Review has always been open to a certain amount of playfulness. We probably wouldn't use the word silly, but I think that this would have actually been found a home in the review. I mean, of earlier times, even when they were publishing early Samuel Beckett, they'd also publish Giacometti's thoughts on going to his first auto show. There's always been a place for playing around. When it's because underneath, I would say, underneath the silliness, there is a pretty serious kind of thinking going on.
Coming back to Angela Flournoy and her book about her story about somebody getting evicted, it demonstrates once again what good observers writers are. And when she talks about, she's describing the look of the people who come to evict her from her apartment, and she didn't really expect them to look like that. But they also have good ears for dialogue too. And I'm coming for this example to Davy Rothbart. In his story, Human Snowball, and good, efficient dialogue. Vernon saying, you want some more advice? Yes, I do. Okay, don't outlive your wife. I mean, a lot is conveyed in just a couple of crisp little sentences there.
Yeah, Davy, I mean, that is, as far as I know, that's all a true story. That's a story about a guy who got on a bus to go visit a girl he had a crush on in Buffalo and ends up meeting one person after another, and he ends up traveling with this gang of people he's never met before to go to this bar where this woman tends bar, who he wants to see. And the first person he picks up is this man Vernon, who's 100 and some years old. He meets him on the Greyhound, and yeah, Vernon gives him the advice not to outlive his wife. Turns out that Vernon was widowed 50 years before. That's a tremendous story.
It really, Human Snowball. I mean, I realized what the title meant as more and more people collected in the back of this Suburban or whatever it was. Yeah, it's just fun to have them all riding around here. We have a call here from Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lauren Stein, the editor of The Unprofessionals and the Paris Review.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Hi.
Good morning, Lauren.
Hi.
Lauren, this might sound like a little stretch, but it's happened before in the past, and I think it could work right now for people who are into like sound bites, like Twitter feeds and things of that nature. What about something called a series or a continuing story where you publish a part of a, say, a full-length novel in the quarterly, but you do it in episodes where it just, it's like, leaves you with a cliffhanger, and so you want more, so it's attractive, so you want to find out what really happened later on.
Well,
something like,
well,
a opera, so...
The next year is in the history of Paris Review. Jamie, listen up.
I have to tell you, Jamie, go to thepaarisreview.org and get a subscription now, because we're doing that with a novel called The Throwback Special by Chris Batchelder. It's a novel all about men who get together every year to reenact the play where Joe Theismann's leg got broken. And of course, it's not really a novel about football. It's a novel about men and how men talk to each other about their lives when they haven't seen each other. It's very funny. And that's something that we've found we've had a lot of success with. We serialized a novel called Outline last year by Rachel Cusk that got a lot of attention, and we serialized a novel by Roberto Bolaño. It's in the tradition of the review, but it's a lot of fun, and one of the things I like is that we get to commission illustrations. And I mean, since I was a kid, I loved seeing the way illustrators interpreted moments in novels.
You know, that key incident in the Throwback Special, anybody who watched that football game or saw the replay of Joe Theismann getting his leg broken on national TV, it was on Monday Night Football. I remember it well. It was probably the most gruesome thing we've ever seen in a football field, so a great event about which to pivot some writing.
Of course. I mean, it's very funny because it's these schlubby old guys. I'm from Washington, D.C., so I remember it too. The idea of these schlubby guys who would think that was something worth reenacting each time with the men playing different parts in the play. It's kind of a genius idea.
I want to talk about some of the poetry in the book. Brenda Shaughnessy with a piece called Life's Work. And here again, you know, just attention to detail, you know, thinking about the drawer pull on the dresser and how it wobbles, yeah, and how to reattach it and that sort of thing.
It's a heartbreaking, that's a cliche, but it really is an intensely sad but resolute and strong little poem about life in a marriage, life in a family, and the way you muddle through. Brenda Shaughnessy is a poet whose work has meant so much to me since she started publishing poems. She's in her very early 40s now. She's published a few collections, and I think she gets stronger and stronger and wiser and wiser. And that poem, it moved me to tears the first time I read it, and it still does.
One can get the impression from an anthology like The Unprofessionals, Lauren, that there's an infinite well of great writing out there. I mean, in truth, it must be shallower than that.
Well, we see many thousands of submissions a year, and we accept much less than 1% of that. And this is our favorite stuff by young writers from the last 5 years, so it's a real distillation. There is a lot of great stuff out there, but as always throughout history, most of it probably isn't of much interest to most people. I mean, it's always of interest to the writer, him or herself, but we have the luxury of being very selective.
You mentioned, and I'm going to cast you in the position of the president of writing right now. You get to give a State of the Union of writing speech. You mentioned the last years, though, being last 5 years being shockingly fertile, and I wonder if there are some things you can attribute that to. Maybe if it's as simple as people didn't have things to do during the recession when they were looking for jobs, and so they wrote or something. What do you attribute this shockingly fertile period?
It's something I've wondered a lot about, and I don't have an answer that I'm convinced of, but I do think that these writers who are, in writer terms, are pretty young. You don't see a lot of people writing interestingly right out of high school or even college, but people in their, typically in their early 30s, or sometimes older, this generation grew up really before the internet was what it's become now, but they came of age at the same time that social media came of age. And I think they have that, they're the kind of, they feel what's being lost, and they've found a way, and I shouldn't speak for them because I don't know if they all would say this about themselves, but it seems this way to me reading them, that they see something that we are in danger of losing that is very important to them, which is a kind of writing in solitude, not writing, not using the word I as a marketing tool, as a professional, personal/professional tool, but finding ways of writing that are not in the marketplace, not hyper-monetized the way things are online. We all have become writers nowadays, you know. Everyone, not everyone, but a lot of us have to spend a certain amount of time every day reading and writing self-promotion. And that is really, really inimical to the kind of writing that we publish in the review. It really rots your brain for that. And I think these writers have gathered up their strength and turned their back on that kind of professional idea of the writer.
I'm embarrassed to say I don't.
I think it took a while for that to happen. Yeah.
I'm embarrassed to say I don't know. Does the Paris Review have a Twitter feed?
Oh, yeah. We've got 500,000 Twitter followers.
Wow. All right. So you have to do the short writing, too. I mean, there's your 140 characters.
I don't do it personally. Mm-hmm. I don't have a Twitter account. I'm not on social media. But you know, we have to find a way of talking to our readers and our potential readers. And I don't mean to slag off the Internet. That's dumb. I mean, it's the only tool that we have left for doing a lot of the stuff that used to be the province of newspapers, especially. You can't turn your back on it, but it's useful to know the difference between what happens online and what happens for marketing, for social media, and what happens in private between a reader and a writer.
Mm-hmm. Would the creators of the Paris Review recognize it today, Lauren? Is it not vastly different from what came before?
They would absolutely. I mean, the first thing I ever wrote for the Paris Review was for George Plimpton. I did an interview for the review then, and there are a lot of connections. John Sullivan, our Southern editor, whom you mentioned before, he did an interview with Guy Davenport for George Plimpton, and our board is made up largely of people who have been around, either people like Mona Simpson, who were editors at the review, or Jeffrey Eugenides, who was published back then, or George Plimpton's widow, or people who've been involved with the review since the early, early days. There's a lot of continuity. It's very strange to have a magazine that is so much attached to its roots. So when we relaunched it, it was really actually, in our minds, to bring it even closer to what it had been doing at the very beginning.
Over the years, are there writers and works you've just raved about, only to get the essence of a meh from readers?
Oh yeah, sure. but I don't really. Every book editor. I mean, the nice thing about the Paris Review is we've got 20,000 readers for every issue, mm-hmm. and that number doesn't really change. People believe in us, and if we say it's good, they keep subscribing, so you don't see big spikes or drops. When I was a book editor, of course, every once in a while we'd publish a book that we thought was terrific and people wouldn't buy it. But my sense is that it's pretty rare that someone whose job is to think all the time about literature, it's rare for a person like that to fall in love without being part of a group, without knowing it. I mean, we're not so special as readers, or at least I'm not special. I think if I love something, there are a lot of people who are going to feel the way I do. I just happen to see it before they do. And if I turn around and nudge the guy sitting next to me at the bar and say, read this, or actually I'm a regular at a place where the bartender reads even more than I do.
So that's great.
He's often doing it to me. But we tend to both like it, you know.
Are there things you've rejected over the years that have either as a book editor or as the Paris Review editor, that people who turned into major heavyweights or their works turned into major heavyweights?
Yes. But, but you know, and I remember one of our contributors, Zadie Smith, teasing me about what a giant mistake I'd made turning down a book that went on to win a bunch of awards and sell very well. And she was right to tease me. She loved the book, but it wasn't something I loved, and that happens too. And the nice thing is that in general, if a lot of people will love it, I'm optimistic, but I think it will find its way, and it doesn't. Not everyone has to agree, you know.
You've talked about the marketing effect on writing, and I would just want to go a little further into the technological end of things and just ask about, since we're dealing with screen sizes now, if writing has changed to fit the boxes we're putting it in.
Well, I'm not sure physically so much, but another contributor of ours, actually Nick Laird, wrote a really interesting essay about this recently. And he talked about the pressure that the internet has put on contemporary poetry. He says it's very hard to write poems that don't try to, in his words, shock or charm. Because that screen, we know that that's expensive real estate. And even if you're reading a poem online, and there are lots of online poetry magazines now, you know, you're in a kind of competition with BuzzFeed or the New York Times Online, that you're not if you pick up a book of Wallace Stevens. And that's something that the Paris Review exists to push back against.
Well, I'm glad
if you're reading the review, you're reading the review.
Well, we're glad you're still here, glad you're going strong, and glad you put out The Unprofessionals. There's some great stuff in it. The Unprofessionals, New American Writing from the Paris Review, edited by Lauren Stein, the magazine's editor. Lauren, thanks so much.
Thank you.